You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
The French Revolution set Europe ablaze. It was an age of enlightenment and progress, but also of tyranny and oppression. It was an age of glory and an age of tragedy. One man stood above it all. This was the age of Napoleon. I'm Everett Rummage, host of the Age of Napoleon podcast. Join me as I examine the life and times of one of the most fascinating and enigmatic characters in modern history. Look for The Age of Napoleon wherever you find your podcasts.
Hey everyone, welcome to episode number 454 of our Civil War podcast. I'm Rich.
And I'm Tracy. Hello y'all, thanks for tuning into the podcast. The June 19th, 1861 editorial in the Charleston Mercury newspaper warned, quote, "War is bloody reality, not butterfly sporting. The sooner men understand this, the better," end quote. And during the four-year course of the Civil War, both North and South would come to that same grim realization.
There were seemingly endless lists of thousands of soldiers killed or wounded in battle and dead of disease. Thousands more, both Federal and Confederate, languished in prisoner of war camps, enduring hardships that previously it had been inconceivable for the civilized people of the North and South to inflict upon one another.
From 1861 to 1865, more than 150 prison camps were established by the Federal and Confederate governments. Estimates of the total numbers of prisoners taken and deaths that occurred in captivity vary widely, and Confederate records are incomplete.
However, the official records of the Union and Confederate armies, the ORs, published after the war, cites a total of 347,000 men, 220,000 Confederate, and 127,000 Federals who endured the privations of being prisoners of war. These hardships ranged from inadequate shelter and clothing, poor hygiene, and the monotonous passage of time, to outright starvation, intentional cruelty, harsh summary justice, swarming vermin, and rampaging disease.
More than 49,000 prisoners died in captivity, at least 26,400 Confederates and 22,500 Federals, an overall mortality rate of 14%. That translates to 12% of Confederate POWs and 18% of Federal captives who never returned from imprisonment.
In the history of the war, Confederate prisons have become notorious for a litany of horrors. But the simple truth is that neither side could claim the moral high ground on this issue. Shamefully, sadly, the four-year-long fratricidal conflict between North and South produced notorious instances of abuse of prisoners by both sides.
When the shooting war kicked off with the Confederate attack on Fort Sumter in April 1861, neither side expected a long conflict involving millions of soldiers. And so, needless to say, neither side entered the war with plans to hold, feed, clothe, and sustain tens of thousands of prisoners of war.
Previous American experience with POW affairs was relatively scant, the most recent being the war with Mexico in the 1840s. Although Union General-in-Chief Winfield Scott had spent time as a POW during the War of 1812, he devoted little attention to the issue before relinquishing command in November 1861.
As the war quickly expanded beyond almost everyone's initial expectations, so did the number and needs of POWs, particularly in the Eastern Theater. Nevertheless, until the middle of 1863, when informal and formal arrangements of exchange foundered, the problems presented by prisoners proved largely manageable by both sides, even if conditions for individuals and small groups were sometimes uncertain or locally harsh.
Many men were exchanged immediately after capture or paroled within hours or days. Those who found themselves subjected to longer periods of imprisonment, over weeks or months, were generally housed in converted warehouses, civilian jails, or makeshift camps.
However, from the outset, the Confederacy suffered shortages of basic commodities, such as medicines, foodstuffs, and textiles, due to a combination of factors, including the Union blockade and a Confederate commissary plagued by poor management. In addition, as the war went on, the South's inadequate and overburdened rail system proved incapable of transporting what supplies were available to the peoples in the cities or the rebel armies in the field.
Unable to provide adequately for Southern civilians and rebel soldiers, the Confederate government faced a significant challenge to care for thousands of Union prisoners. In the North, more plentiful food supplies, the availability of medical care, and the relative abundance of resources should have weighed positively on the treatment of prisoners. However, shamefully, in too many instances, conditions were scarcely better than the worst of the prisons in the South.
Camp Douglas in Chicago and Elmira in upstate New York, among others, left horrible legacies of their own as administrative indifference, ineptitude, and corruption, combined with the desire to dish out the same cruel treatment to rebel POWs that federal captives were rumored to suffer in Confederate prisons.
The burden of feeding and sheltering prisoners steadily increased as the war progressed. Early on, a system of parole and exchange was utilized extensively, allowing thousands of soldiers to return to their units. Patterned after a similar system that had been widespread in Europe, officers of equal rank were exchanged for one another, while enlisted men were exchanged on a one-for-one basis. When an even exchange wasn't immediately possible, officers were exchanged for a certain number of enlisted men, such as one captain for six privates.
When a timely exchange wasn't expected, parole was sometimes extended to prisoners. During the Civil War, any prisoner not exchanged within 10 days of being captured was usually released upon signing a pledge that he wouldn't take up arms again until he was notified he'd been properly exchanged.
At times, parolees went home to await the official exchange. However, these individuals were often reluctant to return to duty. Therefore, paroled soldiers, after returning to their own lines, were frequently confined in camps with other parolees until word of an exchange was received.
Over time, the system of exchange and parole became increasingly unsustainable, mostly due to the sheer numbers of prisoners involved.
For example, with the surrender of Fort Donelson in Tennessee in February 1862, over 12,000 Confederates were captured by federal forces led by Ulysses S. Grant. The rebel commander, Major General Simon Bolivar Buckner, was imprisoned in Boston until he was exchanged, while 7,000 of the captured Confederate soldiers were sent to Camp Douglas, and the rest were scattered throughout other prisons in the North.
Then, in July 1862, the federal and Confederate governments agreed to a formalized program of exchange known as the Dix Hill Cartel, named for its principal negotiators, Union Major General John Dix and Confederate Major General D.H. Hill.
Prior attempts to formalize exchange protocol had been complicated by several factors, not least of which was the fact that since the Lincoln administration viewed the conflict as a civil insurrection rather than a war between two sovereign nations, federal authorities wanted to avoid any action that might legitimize the Confederate government, and a formal agreement to exchange prisoners, in the eyes of many observers, particularly those in foreign governments, might do just that.
Fragile from the beginning, the Dix Hill Cartel survived with limited interruptions for only about 5 months. Then, at the end of December 1862, U.S. Secretary of War Edwin Stanton suspended the exchange of commissioned officers.
To backtrack a bit, that fall, after the Battle of Antietam, when Abraham Lincoln issued his preliminary Emancipation Proclamation, Confederate President Jefferson Davis retaliated by issuing a decree that any white officer captured while commanding black soldiers in battle could be charged with inciting a slave insurrection, and, if punished according to the laws of the Confederate States, could be put to death. This was no idle threat, as increasing numbers of black soldiers were being put into the field by the federal armies. While Stanton's move in December, suspending the exchange of officers, was in response to Davis's proclamation, the cartel itself was left to stumble along, with the exchange of enlisted men continuing, but the process became stressed to the breaking point. Finally, with the Confederates flatly refusing to exchange captured black soldiers for white soldiers, and with the Confederate Congress backing Jefferson Davis's proclamation about white officers leading black troops, the cartel collapsed. On May 25, 1863, Union General-in-Chief Henry Halleck ordered exchanges halted immediately.
Soon after the collapse of the cartel, federal forces captured and paroled tens of thousands of rebel soldiers at Vicksburg, Mississippi, and Port Hudson, Louisiana. The Confederate War Department refused to recognize most of these paroles as valid and eventually simply declared the men exchanged and returned them to duty. When the Federals recaptured some of these men that fall at Chattanooga, Ulysses S. Grant was furious at what he considered Confederate treachery.
Months passed, and the Confederates refused to budge on the issue of captured black soldiers. Just as the Lincoln administration had been reluctant in 1861 to do anything that might suggest the legitimacy of the Confederacy, so now was the Davis administration loath to make any gesture that might legitimize the use of runaway slaves as United States soldiers. Eventually, Jefferson Davis at least partially relented and agreed to exchange black soldiers who had enlisted as freemen, but he stood firm on the issue of escaped slaves. In response, the Federal War Department declared that it would exchange no soldiers if all were not exchanged equally.
Want to learn how you can make smarter decisions with your money? Well, I've got the podcast for you. I'm Sean Piles, and I host NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast. On our show, we help listeners like you make the most of your finances. I sit down with NerdWallet's team of nerds, personal finance experts in credit cards, banking, investing, and more. We answer your real-world money questions and break down the latest personal finance news. The nerds will give you the clarity you need by cutting through the clutter and misinformation in today's world of personal finance. We don't promote get-rich-quick schemes or hype unrealistic side hustles. Instead, we offer practical knowledge that you can apply in your everyday life. You'll learn about strategies to help you build your wealth, invest wisely, shop for financial products, and plan for major life events. And you'll walk away with the confidence you need to ensure that your money is always working as hard as you are. So turn to the nerds to answer your real-world money questions and get insights that can help you make the smartest financial decisions for your life. Listen to NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello, everyone. My name is Wesley Livesey from the History of the Second World War podcast. My podcast is a mostly chronological retelling of the Second World War, and I hope you will join me on a journey through the most cataclysmic conflict in human history as we try to answer the questions of not just what and where, but how and why. Join me on a journey not just through the famous campaigns, battles, and events, but also on a trip around the globe as we broaden the scope of Second World War history beyond the well-known battlefields of Europe and the Pacific. During weekly episodes, I seek to provide new insight for longtime students of the war, while also being a great jumping-on point for anyone seeking a deeper understanding of the Second World War. This podcast has made it to the invasion of Poland in 1939, and start listening now to find out how the world would find itself embroiled in its second worldwide conflict in just 20 years. You can find History of the Second World War on all major podcast platforms or at historyofthesecondworldwar.com.
When Ulysses S. Grant became General-in-Chief in the spring of 1864, he insisted upon two conditions for the exchange of prisoners. One was that, quote, no distinction whatever will be made in the exchange between white and colored prisoners.
And the second was that the Confederates must make good on what Grant considered their breach of faith after Vicksburg. To do so, the rebels would have to release a number of federal prisoners equal to that which the Confederates had sent back to duty in violation of their parole.
But Jefferson Davis still refused to budge on the issue of escaped slaves as federal soldiers, and the Confederate War Department refused to acknowledge any wrongdoing as far as the Vicksburg parolees.
And so there would be no resumption of the cartel under Ulysses S. Grant. In the end, Grant made his peace with this by concluding that continued prisoner exchanges would only serve to prolong the war by allowing the Confederates to offset their manpower disadvantage by returning exchanged troops to their units. In an August 1864 letter, Grant explained his pragmatic perspective on the issue when he noted, quote, it is hard on our men held in southern prisons not to exchange them, but it is humanity to those left in the ranks to fight our battles, since every man released on parole or otherwise becomes an active soldier against us at once, either directly or indirectly.
Although Abraham Lincoln had hesitated to authorize exchanges during the first year of the war, he had bowed to pressure and allowed the Dix Hill Cartel to become operative. Now, however, Lincoln remained notably quiet on the topic, leaving it to Grant to publicly state that future prisoner exchanges would be suspended due to the harsh demands of war.
While politicians and generals debated, prisoners on both sides suffered. Escape attempts occurred with regularity and were occasionally successful. For example, Confederate cavalry raider John Hunt Morgan and a few of his fellow officers tunneled their way to freedom from the Ohio State Penitentiary in November 1863. The largest escape of the war, and the topic of our next episode, took place at Libby Prison in the Confederate capital of Richmond, Virginia, when more than 100 federal officers broke out in February 1864, and 59 of them managed to elude capture.
But successful escapes were the exception rather than the rule at the 150 or so locations that federal and Confederate authorities used to detain POWs during the war. For the men held captive in those places, each of the prisons, almost without exception, was a place of great suffering and constant misery, and death was never far away.
Found among the federal and Confederate prisons are some of the most shameful names in American history. By far the most infamous of Civil War prisons, Andersonville in Georgia, officially known as Camp Sumter, didn't exist until the winter of 1863-64. But by the summer of 1864, the population had grown to more than 20,000, twice its original capacity. At its peak in August 1864, the stockade at Andersonville housed over 33,000 federal soldiers in utter squalor.
With the suspension of prisoner exchanges and with federal forces penetrating ever farther into the heart of the South, Confederate authorities reached the conclusion it was necessary to construct a prison deep in Georgia to house the increasing number of captive enemy soldiers.
A location near the town of Andersonville, in Sumter County, about 60 miles southwest of Macon, was chosen because of its proximity to a rail line, the availability of slave labor, a source of water in the form of Sweetwater Creek that ran through the site, and an abundance of pine trees for the construction of a stockade. Construction began in December 1863. The original stockade occupied 16 and a half acres, with a pair of large gates on its western face.
A fenced perimeter was set between 19 and 25 feet inside the stockade walls. This was the notorious deadline, and any prisoner crossing it would be shot.
On February 24, 1864, the first prisoners, 600 men transferred from Libby Prison, arrived at Andersonville. Captain Henry Wirtz assumed command in April. The population of Andersonville swelled rapidly. In July, Wirtz set the prisoners to work constructing a 10-acre expansion to the stockade. By August, starvation and disease were rampant, and the dead that month totaled almost 3,000.
The creek that ran through the compound quickly became fouled, and the putrid water contributed to an epidemic-level rise in cases of dysentery. No effort was made to construct barracks or any other type of structure to house the prisoners. Many of the men lived in makeshift lean-tos, while others had no shelter at all. In the desperate struggle to survive, military discipline broke down. Prisoners stole from one another and fought over morsels of food. Men banded together into gangs that terrorized the camp.
Private Prescott Tracy of the 82nd New York Infantry was one of only a handful of Andersonville prisoners actually exchanged in 1864. His description of the horrors there was published in a widely circulated pamphlet titled Narrative of the Privations and Sufferings of the United States Officers and Privates While Prisoners of War in the Hands of Rebel Authorities. Tracy recalled, quote, "The newcomers would exclaim, 'Is this hell?' Yet they soon would become callous and enter unmoved the horrible rottenness. The rations consisted of 8 ounces of cornbread, the cob being ground with a kernel and generally sour, 2 ounces of condemned pork, offensive in appearance and smell. Occasionally, about twice a week, 2 tablespoons of rice, and in place of the pork, the same amount, 2 tablespoonfuls, of molasses were given us about twice a month. The clothing of the men was miserable in the extreme. Very few had shoes of any kind. Not 2,000 had coats and pants, and those were latecomers. More than one half were indecently exposed, and many were naked."
From February 1864 through the end of the war, approximately 45,000 prisoners were held at Andersonville. A total of 12,913, or roughly 28%, died and were buried in mass graves. The toll at Andersonville represents 57% of all federal prisoner deaths during the war.
When the war ended, the focus of retribution for all the atrocities perpetrated in Confederate prisons would fall on Henry Wirtz, who was hung on November 10, 1865, in Washington. The debate continues to the present day over whether Wirtz, at Andersonville, was justly convicted or had actually done the best he could in difficult circumstances. A lesser-known figure in the prison drama was Brigadier General John H. Winder, who, beginning in 1864, was the Commissary General of Confederate prisons. He had reportedly turned a deaf ear to Wirtz's reports about the conditions at Andersonville. And earlier, while Provost Marshal of Richmond, Winder had also been responsible for the notorious prison facilities in the Capital area, including Libby Prison, Castle Thunder, and Belle Isle. The 64-year-old Winder conveniently died of a heart attack in February 1865. Had he lived, it's likely that Winder would have joined Wirtz on the gallows.
Among the other prisons located throughout the South, Libby was the most prominent. Consisting of three buildings, each four stories high, the tobacco warehouse complex was commandeered by Winder for use as a prison following the July 1861 Battle of First Manassas. During the war, 50,000 captive federal soldiers passed through Libby.
Besides those who were processed through Libby and sent to other facilities, no fewer than 1,200 federal officers were held captive there at any given time. The windows were barred, and few of them had glass panes, exposing the prisoners to weather extremes ranging from roasting hot to freezing cold. Captives weren't allowed to lie on their blankets during daylight hours and were banned from looking out the windows for fear they might signal Union sympathizers outside.
Bad as they were, Andersonville and Libby Prison weren't alone in their records of suffering and misery. A camp at Salisbury, North Carolina, housed prisoners as early as 1861 after the Confederate government purchased a 16-acre tract, including the three-story main building, six smaller brick buildings, and other structures that had once been used as a cotton mill.
By the autumn of 1864, nearly 9,000 prisoners were held at Salisbury, considerably outnumbering the inhabitants of the nearby town. One prisoner referred to the camp as a, quote-unquote, dark hole. Private Benjamin Booth of the 22nd Iowa kept a daily log of deaths, noting that 58 men died on December 1, 1864 alone, and another 40 on January 12, 1865. More than 15,000 prisoners were held at Salisbury during the war, and approximately 5,000 of them died, a mortality rate of 33% that likely may have actually eclipsed that of Andersonville.
Confederate captives fared little better in federal camps. Captain Francis Marion Headley was captured at the Battle of Champion Hill in Mississippi in May 1863, exchanged, and then captured a second time while on recruiting duty in his home state of Kentucky. Headley was sent to Johnson's Island, just off the coast of Lake Erie and about 3 miles from the town of Sandusky, Ohio.
The prison at Johnson's Island opened in April 1862 and consisted of a dozen two-story barracks and a hospital building enclosed by a wooden stockade. Although the prison was intended to house only 2,500 men, the camp was regularly overcrowded, and as many as 15,000 prisoners, most of them officers, passed through its gates during the war.
The Ohio winters were harsh, and the prisoners subjected to freezing temperatures and bitter winds that swept through the barracks off Lake Erie. Remarkably, only about 300 rebels died at Johnson's Island, but as for Captain Headley, the traumatic experience affected him for the rest of his life and contributed to his declining health.
Elsewhere in Ohio, the Confederate prisoners fared much worse. At Camp Chase, on the outskirts of Columbus, 2,260 captives died. Three separate prison compounds inside the camp encompassed 6 acres and were intended to hold a total of 4,000 men. But at its peak, the population of Camp Chase numbered from 7,000 to 10,000. An estimated 25,000 Confederates transited the camp during its operation from the summer of 1861 through the end of the war. Overcrowding, along with open latrines and cisterns, contributed to a mortality rate of just under 10%.
Camp Douglas in Chicago was the most notorious of the prisons in the North. During its operation, more than 26,000 Confederates passed through its gates, and the estimated number of deaths ranged from 4,500 to more than 6,000. Controversy surrounds the final mortality rate due to allegations that a large number of prisoner deaths were never recorded. On the other hand, it was charged that an unscrupulous contractor simply buried a number of empty caskets to increase his payment from the government. In any case, the generally accepted mortality rate at Camp Douglas is 17 to 23%.
Depending on the sources consulted, the population of Camp Douglas peaked at anywhere from 9,000 to 12,000, fell sharply later in 1862 following an exchange under the Dix Hill Cartel, and then rose significantly by mid-1863. During the winter of 1862-63, an estimated 1,700 prisoners died. A number of Illinois militia and U.S. Army officers were in command of Camp Douglas at various times during its operation. The most infamous was Colonel Charles DeLand, previously commander of the 1st Michigan Sharpshooters. DeLand was known for meting out severe punishments and once had prisoners from the 8th Kentucky Cavalry stand at attention for hours after a tunnel was discovered under their barracks. DeLand ordered the guards to shoot any of the prisoners who sat down. One was killed and two wounded.
As the war went on, federal armies took prisoners in ever-increasing numbers. Of the 12,000 Confederates that passed through the prison at Rock Island, Illinois, 2,000 died. At Point Lookout, Maryland, 50,000 prisoners passed through, and an estimated 4,000 died.
At Fort Delaware, on Peapatch Island in Newcastle County, Delaware, the population grew to more than 13,000 prisoners following the Battle of Gettysburg in July 1863, and swelled to more than 30,000 by the end of the war. In the spring of 1864, the problem of overcrowding had become so severe that a new prison was constructed on the site of a former mustering location for Union troops at Elmira in upstate New York. A stockade was built around the dilapidated camp, and by July, 700 prisoners had been transferred from Point Lookout. A month later, the population of the camp had ballooned to 10,000 Confederate enlisted men.
From the beginning, conditions at Elmira were awful. The prison was below the level of the nearby Chemung River, which made drainage a problem. The barracks could only house about half the prisoners, so the rest lived in tents. With the onset of winter and cold weather, disease was widespread.
By the end of the war, more than 12,000 Confederates had been imprisoned at Elmira, and nearly 3,000 died, a mortality rate approaching 25% and rivaling that of Andersonville, earning Elmira the well-earned nickname of Hellmira. On November 1, 1864, Dr. Eugene Sanger, the camp surgeon, wrote to U.S. Army Surgeon General Joseph Barnes, reporting, quote, "Since August, there have been 2,011 patients admitted to the hospital and 775 deaths. Have averaged daily 451 in hospital and 601 in quarters, an aggregate of 1,052 per day sick. At this rate, the entire command will be admitted to hospital in less than a year and 36% die."
Elmira operated for 15 months, and on July 1, 1865, nearly 3 months after Appomattox, 218 Confederates remained in the camp's hospital. The last prisoner departed Elmira on September 27th.
Federal Commissary General of Prisons, William Hoffman, has been both praised and vilified for his administration of Union prison camps during the war. A career Army officer, Hoffman had been a classmate of Robert E. Lee's at West Point. Captured in Texas at the beginning of the Civil War, he was exchanged in 1862. As Commissary General of Prisons, he was subordinate to Quartermaster General Montgomery Meigs, who had no sympathy to spare on Confederate POWs.
While adequate supplies of food and clothing were available most of the time, many civilian contractors either failed to deliver goods or dealt in such shoddy products that clothing and blankets delivered to the prisons were of such inferior quality as to be almost useless. Likewise, contracted foodstuffs that were delivered to the camps were too often already spoiled and unfit to eat.
Hoffman's stinginess with government money became legendary. Although Congress had appropriated sufficient funds for the purpose of caring for Confederate prisoners, he was unwilling to spend the money on suitable goods or adequate construction, and actually returned $2 million to the treasury at the war's end. When a Confederate officer questioned Hoffman about the ill treatment of prisoners at Camp Chase, Hoffman bluntly stated it was, quote, in retaliation for the innumerable outrages which have been committed on our people, end quote. During the war, Hoffman was brevetted Brigadier General in 1864 and Major General in 1865, and after the end of the conflict, he was officially commended for his, quote, faithful, meritorious, and distinguished services as Commissary General during the Rebellion.
We've tried to be as impartial as possible while covering this important topic of prisoners of war. As we tried to make clear, neither side could claim the moral high ground when it came to the conditions in prisons and their treatment of POWs.
While there's no substantial excuse for what happened at Andersonville, there was also no excuse for what happened at Elmira or Fort Delaware or a number of other northern prisons, especially since the federal authorities had been more capable of feeding their POWs, but deliberately reduced the amount of rations more than once in retaliation for the reported conditions in southern prisons. Never mind that those descriptions also could have fit the condition of nearly every northern prison at the time.
The horrors of captivity commonly associated with Civil War prisons didn't become fully realized until 1864, after exchanges ceased and prison compounds became dangerously overcrowded. On both sides, the prisons became disease-ridden and filthy, and supplies of food, clothing, and medicine were woefully inadequate.
It would be easy to excuse what happened in northern and southern prisons to a system overwhelmed by the demands of the conflict, and that the needs of prisoners simply faded into the background in the face of more pressing concerns. But the truth is that both sides engaged in deliberate policies of mistreatment. For example, in Washington, Secretary of War Edwin Stanton cut the rations of Confederate prisoners in retaliation for the awful conditions reported in southern prisons. While in Richmond, the Confederate War Department ignored Henry Wirtz's reports about the terrible conditions at Andersonville.
Although the death rates in the prison camps are shocking enough, statistics fail to show the number of men who died as a result of their confinement soon after returning home. If it was possible to provide such numbers, the result would surely be staggering.
For many of the men who survived the experience of being held prisoner, it continued to traumatize them to the end of their days. Recent studies and research on survivors of prison camps from World War II and Korea and Vietnam provide some insight into what the POW's condition might have been as they returned home. They often developed what was known after World War II as survivor's syndrome, or after Vietnam as post-traumatic stress syndrome, characterized by the inability to concentrate, ghastly memories triggered by familiar sights, sounds, smells, or events, and lingering medical problems. Memory loss is often serious, and reactive psychotic neuroses occur in many survivors, with paranoia and depression being the most prevalent. Others experience problems with post-war adjustment, finding themselves unable to adapt to accepted behavior or to deal with everyday problems and concerns.
Although there was no diagnosis of PTSD after the Civil War, studies of the accounts of veterans reveal numerous instances of former POWs who returned home and struggled with bitterness, guilt, feelings of humiliation, and apathy. Many suffered with long-term physical illnesses or afflictions. Others obviously choked back the tears and tried to go on with their lives.
It's hard to escape the conclusion that the treatment of Civil War POWs constitutes one of the most shameful episodes in American history. It is, of course, impossible to know the number of deaths and shattered lives that could have been prevented. However, what is clear is that tens of thousands of POWs wouldn't have suffered and died as they did if the civilian officials and military officers who directed the prison systems of the Union and the Confederacy would have cared for them as their own regulations and basic humanity required. Today, Andersonville is a National Historic Site, and fittingly, since 1998, it's also been the home of the National Prisoner of War Museum, which serves to honor all American POWs in all wars.
That means it's time for this episode's book recommendation, and our recommendation this time is Portals to Hell, Military Prisons of the Civil War by Lonnie R. Speer.
Speer's book is an excellent starting point if you want to learn more about Civil War prisons on your own. Speer draws on a lot of firsthand accounts, which is great, but also heartbreaking. It's a hard read, but this is an important part of the Civil War that's not covered in much detail in most histories of the war.
You can find a complete list of all of our book recommendations if you head over to the podcast website, which is www.civilwarpodcast.org.
Also at the website, you can find info on joining the Strawfoot Brigade over on Patreon and help support the podcast in that way, just like the newest members, Donald B., John W., and Branson.
Will T., John Z., and David.
Chad G., John S., and Andrew B.
And thank you to Gary F. and Michael H. for their donations.
Yep, thanks, guys. And thanks to all of you for listening to this episode of the podcast. Tracy and I do hope that you'll join us again next time when we'll look at that breakout from Libby Prison in February 1864. But until then, take care.
Thanks, everyone. Bye.